Welcome to the Dream Hub podcast, a sanctuary where the mysteries of the night intertwine with the creativity of the human spirit. I'm Melissa Johnson, your guide through the transformative world of dreams. Today, I'm joined by the enchanting storyteller and Pushcart Prize nominee, Donna Glee Williams. With her profound connection to nature and narrative, Donna Glee brings us tales woven with the threads of the subconscious. Her latest eco-fable, The Night Field, is a testament to the powerful dialogues with dreams. Let's embark on a literary adventure into the forests of the mind and the meadows of imagination. Thanks for being on the podcast today, Donna Glee.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a delight to be with you, and especially, you know, across the distances that we meet. It still seems miraculous to me.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? All over dreamers, all over the world uniting. I love it. So Donna, since you're on the Dream Hub podcast, I'm curious to hear what first sparked your interest in dreams.
You know, I don't actually know the answer to that question. I remember attending to dreams in childhood. I remember seeking out dream training when I was a young woman in New Orleans, and the Sonoy dream work was fresh and new at that time. I remember looking for that there. Then as a young nurse, I was able to get some a training that had to do more with the Gestalt approach to dream work. I did some work as a psychiatric nurse, and that gave me and in there. And then in my middle years, I was pursuing a doctor of ministry at the University of Creation Spirituality in California. And that's where I met Jeremy Taylor. And that's when the voyage of projective dream work began, and when it began to be a really integral part of my creative process. Met him in 2001 and worked with him until he died in 2018. So that was, you can imagine, a pretty intensive experience. And when I first approached Jeremy, I had never written long form. I had written and published poems and short stories and little theater pieces and essays, but I'd never written a novel. And through the process of doing my own intensive dream work, I wrote and sold three novels. And they, interestingly enough, when I approached Jeremy at this intensive training in dream work that he was offering at my school, I told him that I have this chronic difficulty getting to water in dreams. And interestingly enough, all three of my novels end in some version of getting to water. So I think the work continues.
Yeah, what a relief.
Yeah.
So it sounds like dreams have been with you through your whole life. I'm curious.
Oh, I think so.
What is projective dream work?
Well, that's an interesting question, because projective dream work is the style of dream work where you have someone else work with you, often a group of people, to have a greater basket of associations. And you tell your dream, and then consciously acknowledging that even though you were the night dreamer that brought that dream into the world, that now that you've told it, each person that heard that dream has their own inner version of a dream, their own imagined version, as if you had written a poem, but they read the poem. So you can have your meanings, but now they have their meanings. And in projective dream work, we respectfully tell each other, if that were my dream, it might be talking to me about X. Or in my imagined version, it might be symbolizing Y. And the beauty of that is you have the rich network of associations that other people bring. And the touchstone is when you hear something that rings your bell, that gives you an aha sense, a gut sense of rightness, of, oh, good grief, how could I not have seen that? It's so obvious. Then they have brought you something that probably has to do with you. And if it doesn't bring you that sense of wonderful connection, then, you know, you just let it go and let it be part of their meaning of the dream. Now, Jeremy Taylor actually believed that all dream work was projective dream work, that everyone that dares to say to someone else, oh, I think your dream is about X or Y, is in fact bringing their projections consciously or unconsciously, and that it is better, safer, and more courteous for us to go ahead and acknowledge them. And so in the dream circles that I lead, I tend to use the structures of projective dream work that we each acknowledge that we are projecting, and slide in and out of also using gestalt insights and techniques that are associated with Sonoy work and active imagination and some guided imagery kinds of things. So it's kind of a fluid practice for my dreamers.
Mm. I can see that there's a big difference, and it was probably a great thing you start with the gestalt, I never pronounce it right, gestalt way. And that's a lot of like the dreamer knows you need to question them and they should like check out what they think each object is, and it all comes from inside. But I like then as well the projective dream work, because it's like you said, we do all do that. We naturally be like, oh, I've had a dream like that, or, and we can mm-hmm. give our own associations. So it's sort of blending the two together to get an introspective and extrospective. What's the word?
Sure. Let's go ahead and say extrospective. I think that's a great word. Yeah. And you can external patent it. I like it.
Great. We'll go with that. Yeah. You get a whole round of all different perspectives. And you need that with dream work, don't you? Because it's not just, well, it's usually never just one thing that the dream's trying to tell anyway. Usually there's multiple things. Yeah.
And that was one of the fundamentals that I learned from Jeremy Taylor. And he said it so many times in so many ways, that dreams are like good poetry. You know, they have meaning on multiple levels. And so, you know, a dream can have to do with what you ate and the current political situation in your country and your health and your situation at work. It can all be bundled in. And that's why it's such a gift to do dream work in groups, you know, because meaning can pop up from anywhere, and you will know it when you hear it.
He sounds like he was an amazing teacher.
He was, and when he died, it was an utterly devastating thing for me, and I think for everyone that worked with him, because I think the level of intensity and intimacy that dream work folk have with the people that work with them is just, it's very hard to describe how strong that is. After he died, unexpectedly, I stopped the dream practice. I stopped recording dreams. I stopped doing the work. I just set it aside. And, you know, I had most of my third novel, which I had worked with him for so long about, The Night Field, most of it was completed. But to actually bring it to a close without the hand-holding, you know, of my great teacher was very difficult. And it was actually not a night dream, but a mushroom ceremony where I recovered that part of my life, because the manuscript was ready to go to my agent. And I was doing this mushroom ceremony, and I brought the manuscript and put it on the mesa. And that whole ceremony wound up being about acknowledging the loss of a great teacher and what a important role he had had in my life. And sometimes in our society, I think we acknowledge the power of the death of a spouse or a parent or blood kin, but I'm not sure that we have containers to acknowledge the strong losses of our major teachers. So that served that way for me. And then the book that his fingerprints were so bright on went out into the world and was able to get sold. And, you know, there was a certain amount of wrestling with my agent over The Night Field. There always is that kind of thing. But it got out big. And also unlocking that locked room of dreams added another layer to my life, because he had, in our last years together, told me, you know, you could go out and hang out your shingle and do what I do. This apprenticeship you've had with me over these years is much more extensive than, you know, the certification programs we run. But I had never had the hunger to do that. It had always been about my own creative process. But after that time, and then when the pandemic began and we were all looking for what can we give, what can we offer, that's when I started running, you know, first one and then two and then more dream circles online. And that has given great joy. And I know you know what startling wonder it can be to accompany dreams and to hold the space for dream exploration. And so it's just a outrageously marvelous part of the world to occupy.
Wow, that's beautiful. I want to hear about your book, but first I just want to rewind a little bit and go back to the part where you said that a mushroom journey helped you to sort of reconnect with your dreams and help you with the loss of your teacher. Can you explain, did you have like a vision, or you just had a really strong dream come through? Like, what happened for you? If you don't mind sharing, you don't have to.
Yeah, quite a lot happened, because, you know, this is like an 8 or 10 hour experience. But I think I walked in not knowing that it was going to be about that. But I knew that the book was getting ready to go off to my agent. So I put it on the mesa, the altar. And then, as the process went on, it was all about memories and presences and acknowledgement of something that I had kind of just shoved away, like that hadn't happened, that it hadn't been important. And it had, and now I see even more, because it wasn't just about the writing. It was about the claiming of that whole aspect of reality in my life. And I know that's not terrifically detailed, but how can you describe, you know, my mushroom ceremony in sweet detail? But it just unlocked it, and I found it again, and I found him again. And, you know, there's so many YouTubes of him teaching available, and to hear his voice again and to recover the memories. And also, it's almost as if my own role as a dream worker, not just a writer, but a person who creates safe containers for people, and specifically a lot for other creatives to explore their dreams for insights and creative sources, that door just fell open. You know, that was like, okay, ready to go now.
That's great. So yeah, it sort of sounded like that. Once he was gone, it was like, because you were doing dreaming with him, then he was gone, it was like almost too painful for you to even look into dreaming at the time, or going there with what felt like alone, even though obviously you're not. But then the mushrooms helped you to see the whole situation from a different perspective and sort of put the hurt aside and then see the importance and all the other ways that you still have him in your life.
Yeah. I think that's a good description. I don't know that I put the hurt aside as much as acknowledged it, but that can be a step towards putting it aside. But it was a lovely reclaiming of an important relationship.
That's beautiful. So now I want to hear all about the book. So in the description of this podcast, I described it as an eco-fable. So for those who don't know, it's like an ecological fable or an environmental fable. And it's a type of a story or literary work that contains a moral lesson related to like the environment or nature or our relationship with Earth. And these stories can use like animals or fantastical elements or fictional scenarios to convey messages about the importance of preserving things like the natural world, highlighting consequences of things like environmental neglect, pollution, or unsustainable practices. So they do serve to educate and provoke thought, often aiming to inspire change or promote more sustainable behaviors to their audience. Donna Glee, could you share what the story behind your book is?
Yes, that's a wonderful way to phrase it, because there is a story behind the book. And that's a waking world story about some people. The ones that I am most intimately familiar with and that I will talk about are in India. And this is a community of very, very poor farmers that had for generations been doing sort of ordinary food farming. But in the contemporary world, they needed to start earning cash. And in order to bring in money, they began to farm cotton. And cotton is absolutely devastating to the soil. And yet it is something that you can certainly earn money doing. And in order to successfully farm cotton, they began to use pesticides and chemical additives to the soil. And in the early days, That was very effective. And yet, the same thing that happened, that happens in many places, happened to them, and that was that their insects developed resistance to the pesticides. So very quickly, they had to use more pesticides and more types of pesticides and more, and became entrapped in a vicious cycle of pesticide use that destroyed them economically, because eventually their crops cost more to bring in than they could earn by selling them, and destroyed their health because they were spraying massively without appropriate protective gear, and including women, children, and pregnant mothers. So horrible things were going on. And because of the economic devastation that it was causing, they were also having to put their children out for indentured labor. And yet something happened where one man, supported by one incredibly heroic guy by the name of Vinumadov, Karnadi Vinumadov, one man tried to bring in a harvest without using pesticides and proved it could be done. And then a couple, and then the whole village. And eventually that village got free from pesticide use. And eventually they, like alcoholics sponsoring each other, began to help other villages get free from pesticide use, until it became a regional movement in that part of India. And I was part of trying to bring attention to this story back in 2008. My mentor, Gerald Martin, who is the founder of the Eco-Tipping Points theory and project, and also the author of the book, Human Ecology, he and I wrote an academic article about what had happened there, because it was incredibly important. You know, the way that they were able to reverse a vicious cycle needs to be understood, because we have vicious cycles happening everywhere, and we need not to think that they are all separate. We have to start thinking systematically about what do these things share and how can we tackle them. So he and I wrote an academic article for a journal called The Ecologist, but the story kept working in me. My sort of novelist storytelling heart just kept grinding around that story. And it began to add other layers that had to do with chattel slavery in the American South, and sharecropping in the South, and the terrible takeover of the United States fruit companies in Central America back in the 20s and 30s. And they all have remarkably similar patterns. The labor camps in Nazi times, they all have their individuality, but they have patterns. And the story, and I so wanted this to be a short story because I'm just a lazy hound. I tried to write a short story about somebody that was grappling with that. And it didn't work as a short story. It was, everybody told me it was too preachy and said I should just leave it be. But it just wouldn't leave me alone. And I kept working on it. And it kept getting longer, and it grew into the night field. And I am one of those writers. I don't know if your listeners have heard the terms pantsers and plotters, but in the fantasy world, you have plotters, and those are the people that outline their plots ahead, and they know what they're doing, and they just do it. And the pantsers are the ones that fly by the seat of their pants. And I am extremely that. And so once I get started on a story, I have to find out how it's going to end, you know, because I don't know. So I just kept pushing on. And I was very fortunate. You know, it's not always that a writer gets tapped by a story that is important, not just to it, to their heart, but to the world. And this story of the human cost of pesticide use, of industrial farming, is something that I am willing to put a lot of energy to try to help people understand what I was able to understand by going and meeting people and seeing their stories, their lives. And of course, I could never tell their stories. I'm not that kind of writer. It would take living their stories or doing extraordinary amount of research, but I am a fantasy writer, and I can put those elements together and offer them to the world in a way that I hope people can see them afresh.
I can see why you got so passionate and were able to just keep going and finish it, because it's like when you feel like you're doing something that could be saving lives on a huge scale, it's like I wouldn't be able to sleep. I would have to finish it as well and be like, let's get this out to people, you know, like there comes the drive. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. So could you share with us how dream work influenced this narrative?
Yes. I would say that the first part is the long arc, you know, the part that where I was not able to write any long forms until I did start working with Jeremy. But the sessions that I had with Jeremy would often involve sharing dreams and sharing text from the book, and just exploding them and exploring them to see what was going on there. And I guess one of the fundamental gifts he gave me as I was just fumbling with some scenes had to do with the realization that my book was capturing a moment in human history where we were shifting from the kinds of people who simply received the gifts of the earth as we would the gifts of a mother, that we simply took what was given, shifting from that state to the point of active agriculture in a way that must have seemed very much like a kind of rape to early people, you know, where you were digging violently into the mother and forcing the mother to bear, that would be a moment of human trauma, cultural trauma, that I had not put consciously into my mind. And that's probably good, because, you know, when you're writing a book, you need to just ride the story and take it. But when he gave me that reflection based on texts and dreams, it helped me see the shape of my book and why the book is basically a vision of two worlds, one before and one after the invention of industrial agriculture. The other thing, though, when I work with my own dreams, I become a little bit fluid about my moving in and out of dreamy states, dreamlike states. So when I write, I am able to sort of relinquish control. It's almost like the opposite of lucid dreaming, where you're trying to take your consciousness into the dream world. I am bringing the dream state into the waking world. So that would be a guide in the direction of the story, of just seeing what would happen, almost like in active imagination. But also, especially, the novel has parts where people are in dreamlike altered states, and it's very flowy for me to get there. So I don't even know if I should claim those as my own dreams. They're somebody's dreams, but there they are on the page. And another part of dream work, if you're doing gestalt dream work in your own journal, is what I call head hopping, where you are speaking from first one entity and then another entity and then another entity. That is incredibly fruitful for a writer, because if you read my book, you will see that it comes from different entities. You know, this person speaks, that person, that tree speaks, you know. So the gestalt dreamwork journaling limbers you up to be able to get story from different entities.
That's so creative. That's really cool. I love how you said it's like the opposite of lucid dreaming, because, you know, like in lucid dreaming, you're trying to become aware and be conscious and be really like focused, and you're trying to do the opposite and get like dreamy and put the conscious mind sort of to the side or to the back seat and let it flow from the subconscious, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I've never actually articulated that way before. So kudos to the question.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that's really interesting. I love that. So you talk about the dream circles a fair bit that you do, and these obviously inspire creativity. I'm curious, what has been the most surprising outcome of these gatherings?
Well, I'm so glad you asked, because one of the things that happens in these gatherings is often usually at the end of working on someone's dreams, we will go to the Sonoy moment of saying, okay, if you're a member of a tribe of people that want to respect a dream, just hypothetically, what would you make or find or enact to honor this dream? You know, and some of my people, they work in art forms that take a long time to develop. So that's why I say hypothetically, you're like, okay, maybe you will not weave the entire rug, but what would you sketch, or what would you, what poem would you write, or something like that? And so one of the things that happens for all of us is sometimes we are touched by what has happened in the dream circle. And for years now, if I've been touched in a poetry way, I've sometimes written a poem and just given it to the person, you know, just as a gift, but never, you know, big deal, like submit or all that. But one of my colleagues, and I have his permission to share this, because Well, we had to discuss it. Anyway, he brought a dream that was so powerful for me that I remember while we were doing it, I said, Jay, you could write a novel based on this dream. And at the end, I said, now, Jay, I really do think this dream could become a story. And if you're not going to write it, I am. And he said, go for it. And so I wrote the story Reflections based on someone else's dream. And it was good. I mean, this was not just a little casual giveaway kind of thing. I recognized that this had captured me so deeply that it was a powerful and interesting story. But then I had this story based on another dreamer's dream. Well, what do you do then? I really had not ever dealt with the ethics of that. You know, we have said in my dream group, sometimes people dream for each other. Okay, that's cool. We have said that you have your own version of the dream once you hear it. But this was bringing it down to the mat. I was going to submit this for publication. And you know, it was like, okay, what do I do? Okay, I have to at least acknowledge him as the dreamer. And then I was thinking, no, my mentors in graduate school said always, when you're sharing a collaboration, do the most generous thing in terms of sharing credit. So it came out under both of our names and just came out in Psychological Perspectives. Like I got this last week. And it was beautiful because it's their issue called Divine Darkness. And it's under both of our names as co-authors with the sort of blurb underneath that it was dreamed by one person and written by another. And it was totally startling in way, you know, dream work is often startling because the moments of insight or the moments of synchronicity will just knock you sockless. But the idea of finding a story that is clearly, you know, my story, otherwise I would not have had the juice and the detailing to bring that to life. But finding it in someone else's inspiration was just staggering. And I think we're going to try to pull something together, maybe not for this IASD, but maybe for another meeting where we will maybe walk people towards the raw material of what it looked like in his journal and what it became to show how that layering. And since then, never that strongly, but I quite recently had the thing where the layout in one of his dreams, the landscape was very much like the dream I had had the previous night. And I should say his name because this is partly his story, you know, Jay Joslin, and he's another dream worker and a hell of a dreamer. So look it up, Psychological Perspectives. The story is called Reflections.
That's great. I can actually put a link in the show notes. So if you're listening, you can just scroll down and click on the link to get that book.
That would be lovely.
So you resonated with his dream when he shared it in the group, but did you feel as though you dreamt the same dream, or did I understand that wrong?
No, I didn't. I didn't dream the same dream at all. I just, when he brought the dream, I felt that world open around me as I would a novel, like when I'm imagining a novel and suddenly there seems to be a landscape and society and history it's stretching out in all directions. I could feel that it startled the hell out of me. But,
I've had that before. Like some people, when they explain their dreams, I struggle to actually picture what it was like. And then other people might tell me their dream and it's like, I could blink and feel like I'm in it and see everything all around. And is that what it was like for you? Like, sort of imagery and imagination just went wild?
I think that's a good description. You know, I have experienced in another context with the night field a sense that other people had access to the same story I had. Like the story had some kind of reality in a story space where I was laying my hand on it as writer. My editor, Joe Fletcher, was laying her hand on it some other side, but she somehow had access to the same story. And as an editor, she was able to ask me the questions that caused me to retrieve more of the story. And then I experienced it with the musician, Lynn Morgan Rosser. She, with my permission, wrote an EP of about six songs based on the book, which she had not read. I mean, she'd read an early draft years before. She didn't need to read it again. When she started writing this music, it was like she had her own private door into it. And that is also a link. If people want to hear the amazing music Lynn created called Songs for the Night Field, that was another astonishing experience, you know, to have someone be able to just access a story and present it in an entirely different art form, you know, the music, singing, lyrics.
I wonder, just on a side note, if I could somehow get access to any of those songs.
You absolutely can. Her music is available on all streaming platforms, and also on her own website. There is a player, and it would be a lovely lift to her to bring that music farther out into the world.
Great. So it was Lynn Morgan Rosser. I'll put links in the show notes as well, so people can go directly to it and hear it.
Excellent. Excellent.
So for those who are new to Dream Circles or thinking about going and haven't yet gone or they've only just started, what would you say is the key to unlocking their creative potential within dreams or within the circle? What advice would you have to anyone going?
Ah, I love this question. I would say the first thing is to get with other people. You know, there's a thing that we say in projective dream work that the dreamer is uniquely blind to the meaning of the dream. Like, if you know what your dreams mean, you wouldn't need to dream them. You know, there would just be an awareness. But if you get with someone else and put your dreams out, and then they say, oh, it might be about this, and you go, oh, of course, why didn't I think of that? Then you have truly gotten something that you weren't quite conscious of, but you were ready to get conscious of. So I really have lamented for some of my creative friends that say they do dream work and they just do it privately. They just do it within their own mind. I do think that getting into a dream circle or getting with at least one other friend or partner or therapist is a lovely gift that you can give yourself. And then for me, the idea of the Sonoy style dream work that you would make or seek or enact something to honor your dream is a really straightforward way to make work happen. And I've actually led dream circles of total strangers that when we propose this idea, and not just for the person who dreamed the dream, but for everyone, what would you do? Amazing ideas leapt out. I was doing one at a Comic-Con, one of the women in the group basically outlined a surrealist comic right there in like the 3 minutes of the question. So I just love the idea. What would you make, do, or seek to honor this? And then I would say also, get playful in your journal. If you're doing dream work, you're almost certainly doing dream journaling. I have a hard time picturing dream work without dream journaling. And of course, one way of doing things is you simply record the dream in as much detail as you possibly can. Okay, that's a great basic place to start. But there's fancy stuff that you can do. And one is to move the dream recording as much towards automatic writing as you can. And what that means to me is to write fast without thinking, and without correcting and without self-editing. You just rush ahead. Now, that invites the subconscious to come to the page, but it also improves your own muscles for writing from your deeper places in other contexts as well. So one idea is move the recording towards automatic writing. And the most useful person I've ever read on this is Natalie Goldberg's Writing Down the Bones. She has a set of simple rules for writing practice, you know, that basically write fast, don't correct, don't think, all of that. And then the other way that you can get playful is either think of it as Gestalt head hopping or Jungian active imagination, you've got the basics of the dream. Now let's let the different elements speak. Okay, now that elements have spoken, let's see if they'll get into dialogue. What will happen if we put them in a room together? And if you don't generate something weird and interesting from these practices, I will be very surprised. These are juicy, playful practices. And then, you know, one of Natalie Goldberg's rules is always go towards the feeling, go towards the emotion. In our waking a world, walking around, we're often about pushing down the emotion because we want to continue to function. But in the privacy of our journal, just put your head down and go straight towards it, you know, and wherever that emotion is, that's where the power will be. That's where the juice will be. And the Senoi phrase that I learned was fear is the arrow of power. You know, you move towards the feared, you find the power. But then the next step, like all that automatic writing practice, is where you get the material you're going to carve. And then after you've got some pages, that's when you're free to admit the other parts of you to the room, the editor part, the analytical part, the part that knows what you want to do or recognizes power in writing. And a basic thing and this is something my dream work groups can do for each other, is identify the phrases that have the power. You know, there might be a word or a phrase or a single small thing. That's where the juice is. And that's where art lies, you know, whether you're a painter or a writer, or some of my people are weavers and dyers, you know, that's where the interesting thing will be, the gold.
Wow. I love all of that advice. There's like the little one-liners. Is that what you're talking about? Sometimes a dream character might have said something to you, or it might be like, and in that moment I thought blah, blah, blah. And it might just be mm-hmm. like a little snippet here or there. And it's like,
whoa. Little tiny snippets, but you can feel them. If you speak them to a group, you can feel the punch, or the group, if you don't feel it, the group can flag it and say, that's where I felt oomph. You know, that's where there's juice or fire. And those phrases with fire are the bones of what you can make. Dreams have the basic elements of good art already baked in. They have associative richness. They have powerful emotion. They have sensory vividness. They have everything you need to make good art. And if you approach them with humble gratitude, you can't miss.
Are you going to the IASD conference this year?
I am. I will be there. I'm going to be sharing the story of my wrestling with the dear old hero's journey, as I wrote The Night Field. And I will also be leading a morning dream group for creatives that would like to do it. And we will have a very short time. We just have an hour, but I would love to, you know, meet any creatives that want to play in this playground with us.
That's going to be amazing. And guess what? I'm coming.
Oh, excellent. So we will meet in four dimensions. Excellent.
Yes. Excellent. Good. Yeah, we'll have to catch up over there. I'm going to do a few interviews with the presenters. So maybe if you'd be willing, I could pop you on my list.
I would love that. I would be thrilled.
Excellent. That's going to be so exciting. Before we go, could we touch on the topic of the hero's journey and hear a little bit of a preview or anything to share about the topic?
Yes. And I have to say, I'm tempted to give you the whole spiel, but I realize that if you're going to be at IASD, I should save something back. But so here's the deal. I am a fantasy writer. I can spot a hero's journey a mile away. And when I launched on writing The Night Field, I was pretty sure I knew what was going to happen. I was pretty sure that my young hero was going to hear the call to adventure, was going to refuse the call, was eventually going to go. Good things, bad things would happen, good things would come back, and it would be fine. And I wrestled and wrestled and wrestled with that story. And it would not work. I could not bring my main character back home with the boon that the hero always brings back. And it wasn't until after I wrote it that I began reevaluating the hero's journey and realized the hero's journey was brought to us 70 years ago by a brilliant, charismatic teacher, Joseph Campbell, white, Western type, and his work was picked up by a brilliant, white male movie maker, George Lucas, who spread it around in the Star Wars movies, and by a white American male journalist by the name of Bill Moyers, and by a white American male movie executive by the name of Chris Fogler, who made it basically scripture in Hollywood. And that as the world walks forward into the crisis that we are moving into, the climate crisis and the global shifts that are happening related to that, that it will no longer be enough for us to imagine single individualistic heroes that are able to get the whole thing done on their own. That just isn't going to work anymore. We're going to have to expand our definition of heroism to be more inclusive of the experience of women who are basically, by nature or nurture, I don't know the answer, but basically more collaborative. And that was the solution to my writing the book, was a brilliant American female science fiction writer by the name of Kit Johnson read an early draft of the book and told me, oh, this story is too big to be carried by one hero. You're going to need more than one hero. So my book, The Night Field, you know, has braided three heroic lives together, one very focused and two kind of implied. And this didn't come to me until later, and it was partly through my brilliant editor, Joe Fletcher, that we have to acknowledge that whenever the hero leaves on a journey, someone stays behind. And the hero's staying is also part of the story that we need to add to the human story of heroism. The people that have stayed historically have often been wives or mothers. So, of course, that didn't get looked at. But around the globe today, there are whole swaths of people where heroism is defined by staying on the same plot of land and raising a handful of children successfully to reproductive age. That's heroism. It isn't about going over there and getting their stuff. And I guess the last thing I'd like to say about the hero's journey is that it is the story that also illuminated imperialism, land theft, people theft, goods theft, the idea that the hero goes over there and gets the good stuff and brings it back here. The hero's journey hasn't always moved in the direction of justice, you know. So it needs questioning. It needs to not be assumed to be the path that the heroes of our tomorrow are going to need to take. And I think we're beginning to see this in fantasy and science fiction. We see, you know, leagues and teams of superheroes are showing up now. And what our popular media offer as heroism is not irrelevant. You know, people have to hear the stories of heroism before they can live into them. So I want to inspire my creative colleagues to explore a broader vision of heroism in their storytelling so that we can have a broader vision of heroes in the waking world.
That's really badass.
Thank you.
I love it.
That's what we aspire to.
I love it. You know, you really, I wonder what your, have you ever figured out what your human design is? Have you had one of those things done before? I don't know what it is. You'll have to figure it out. But you put in like where you were born and what time you were born and all these details, and it tells you what personality type you are. And there's, so I'm what's called a projector. So sort of like a projector screen, I suppose. I see things and then I can explain them to people in a different way. So usually everyone in my house sees things one way and I view it a different way and then explain it to them. Do you know what I mean? And my husband's called a generator. So his is the one that like he gets stuff done. So if I think of something crazy, then I go to him and he gets it done. But we've all got these different personalities. I think there's like 5 or 6 different types. And just by listening to you and the way that you view things and see things differently to then create like mass change in the world, I'm just wondering if you're a projector as well, because you're seeing things in a different light to way other people are. And then being able to change it right down to the core to create huge change. It's just interesting the way that your mind works.
It would make me very happy, you know, that I love it that that's what you are as a podcaster, because I think that would be just a fabulous description of what you do. And I certainly, that's what I want to do. I want to do the big work.
You definitely are. Like, if you think of how many people you could be impacting through the stories in your books and all the research that you've done and the word that you're spreading, not only like environmentally, but for younger generations and our health and everything like that. And then you're also going in and looking at the hero's journey and the way that we treat ourselves and the way that we go through the world and our belief system about who we should be and the impact we should be making. And you've come through in these two huge different areas, but just sort of are highlighting the reality that it should be, and not like going along blindly hiding these few things here that are going to greatly impact us into the future. You're like, hang on a minute, like you've all just brushed over these things, like everything's fine, but if you just highlight these little things, like the rest of the world will be able to actually flourish instead of, like you said, like damaging itself. And especially with women and the way that we view ourselves and what we're expected to do versus what we want to do and how that makes us feel, like we do need a lot of lifting up and people seeing everything that we do and looking at what our needs are and how that is different to what we're actually getting or viewed to be doing at the moment. So well done. Bravo. The world needs more Donna Glees.
Well, I you know, if I was choosing my t-shirt phrase from what you said, it would be, hang on a minute, you know, that would be something I would love to represent.
That's so cool. You're doing an amazing job. In what ways do you see dream work evolving in the literary world?
I think that one of the things I see is that the literature of the dream world, I would say, is fantasy. And what I see is that there is a more permeable membrane between what I think of as mainstream literature and what I see as sort of ghettoized genre fantasy. So that a good deal of what is now being sold without the tag of fantasy on the cover, you know, is now admitting the dream world. I just finished reading Clara and the Sun, which is a book by Kazuo Ishiguro. And he's a Nobel Prize winner. And he wrote a straight up science fiction story from the point of view of an artificial intelligence, you know. So, and nobody says, oh, that's not worth living, or the time traveler's wife, you know, a fantasy about being married to a time traveler. These things are adding on to the richness of possibility of just everyone now, not just those of us that are in our nerdy little ghettos. So I'm very pleased about that. And I'm also pleased about simply the presence of dreams in books. You know, when I went through in the area of fantasy and science fiction, there are some basic what they call boot camps where you go and have an intensive training in that in the profession, how to make it work for you. And I remember being told in the one that I went to, you know, don't put dreams in your fiction. They're boring, you know. And of course, now I've written three books where they're essential, you know, the dreams. The dreams brought the stories. The dreams are in the stories. The stories are in the dream. You know, it's all there. So I'm very pleased that even millimetrically, we're inching the world back towards a place of respecting dreams. And the work you're doing here with your podcast, you know, just bringing dreams back to people, I think is a planetary healing act. So yay.
Yay. Yes, thank you. Yeah, I think so too. It was like a long time ago, there was dreams were a big part of communities, and then it sort of all got shut down, even to the point like in Australia, dream work used to be on our healthcare system. And then in 2009, they cut it out.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm wow. Like,
it's suspect, you know, it's a bit dodgy, and I am just, it just makes me want to speak louder. Because I know Good. How healing it is for everybody. And so, yeah, there is a big divide of people that say dreams don't mean anything and it's all crazy talk and whatever. But until you've experienced it, which it doesn't take long to sort of realize the power in them, then we can just share it to everybody. And I just, yeah, I honestly believe if we all paid attention to our dreams, the world would be able to heal itself. Like just even through my own dreams, like you said, in taking action from the dream, that's probably one of my favorite parts about dream work. And I've got a to-do list from like a dreams to-do list of all the things that my dreams have reminded me or inspired me to do. And I'm ticking through Beautiful. Them like day out. It's long. So much stuff comes through. But yeah. It's very inspiring and healing, and it gives me something positive to focus on. So it's definitely changed my world. I'm glad that you're flying the flag with me, but like, do you know what I mean? You're
sure
getting I'll the fly message a flag with out you. There. Yeah, you're getting the message out there about dreaming, but also about just being aware of the things that we can do to impact changes into the future for the mm-hmm. whole world. And that's really, really inspiring.
Good.
Is there anything today that you wanted to speak about that I haven't asked you about?
Well, I will say that my beautiful The Night Field is coming out in paperback this very month, I believe. So that's, no, April. And that's very exciting. Would definitely love to see dreamers at the International Association for the Study of Dreams, and I hope that you know, we've talked a lot about me, but if I get to see you there, maybe we can hear your dream story. That would make me very happy. And what else? I guess we have covered a lot. So I would leave it that if people do want to support the environmental message of the Knight Field, that this paperback that is coming out this spring will have a list of questions for discussion by Dr. Gerald Martin, who is the fundamental thinker behind eco-tipping points theory. And it would be a valuable tool for book groups or classrooms that want to study the book not just as literature, but as an exploration of how successful eco-tipping points happen. There's patterns to that. And if people want to support that message getting out, then a kindness you can do is ask your local library to buy the book. Of course, it's lovely if people buy it themselves, but if you ask a library to buy it, it will be there for a while.
Yeah, and then multiple people can read it as well. That's really good advice. As we close this chapter with Donna Glee Williams, I'm leaving with my heart and mind a little fuller, and I'm hoping you listeners are as well. I'm enriched by the stories and the songs that dreams can inspire. And if you're enchanted by the sounds of this lush narrative of the Knight Field, and you also wish to hear the melodies that it's birthed, go down below, and I've got the links there for Songs of the Knight Field on Spotify and for you to be able to purchase Donna Glee's book. Donna Glee, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you with me here today, sharing your wisdom and dream-inspired tales. Thank you for coming. And I can't wait to meet you in person in the Netherlands.
It's been a delight. Thank you so much for having this wonderful conversation. And I hope between us, we are edging the world back into the dream wisdom.
Yes, I feel it. We are. Thanks, Donna Glee.
See ya.